Scene 37 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I have been hosting the morning show for many, many years and have literally talked to thousands of authors over the course of my many years here. I count it as a very, very special privilege indeed to be talking for the next few minutes with Richard Hurwitz about one of the most amazing and inspiring books I have ever read. The book is titled In the Garden of the Righteous, The Heroes Who Risked Their Lives to Save Jews During the Holocaust. This is the story of some 10 individual stories, although in those 10 stories, it's not always a single individual. In fact, very rarely are we talking about a single individual, but notable figures who were part of this massive effort in many quarters of the world to try to save Jews who were under severe threat of capture, arrest, deportation, and of course death. And the way this played out was in some ways dramatically different in various settings and scenarios. But what of course ties all of these stories together is the incredible courage and also innovation that was also a part of these rescue efforts. And these stories are gathered together by writer Richard Hurwitz, founder and publisher of the Octavian Report. His work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the London Times, and many other places. He has done superb work with this marvelous book, which is published by HarperCollins, and again titled In the Garden of the Righteous, The Heroes Who Risked Their Lives to Save Jews During the Holocaust. Richard Hurwitz, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you for having me, and thank you for your kind words.
If you don't mind me mentioning another book briefly, the only other book I can remember in all my years doing the morning show in which I was comparably moved was a book called Salvaged Pages by Alexandra Zapruder. And I'm not sure if you're acquainted with it, but it is a collection of Holocaust diaries by young people. Diaries like the diary of Anne Frank, but it's not her diary, but others somewhat similar to it. And the reason I bring up that remarkable book is because in that book, for the first time, I began to understand in a new way the plight of those who were fleeing for their lives in the midst of the chaos and darkness of the Holocaust. And in such a strange way, your book is a very similar experience, but in a sense, it is told from a position of light that is telling a story that is in so many ways heartbreaking and bleak, and yet telling it from that place where good was done. I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about that interesting place. It's not exactly a place of ambiguity, but the presence of light in the midst of such darkness. It seems to me that that is at the heart of what your marvelous book is all about.
Yes, that's a nice and poetic way, I think, of putting it. I quoted in the book, there's a quote by Martin Luther King, the effect of, darkness can't drive out darkness, only light can do that. And there are other, there's a poem by actually a woman who gave her life. She was Jewish, but a paratrooper who tried to rescue Jews, and she also made a similar comment about, these people being flickers of light. And I think we need to focus on the fact that they really were flickers of light and not a large, strobe light because rescue was so rare during the Holocaust. You know, there have been 27,000 people rescued, honored at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem with the title Righteous Among the Nations, which has very stringent criterion. And that sounds like a lot of people, but it's out of a population in Europe at the time of about 500 million. So, you know, one way of thinking about that is if you had a stadium like Madison Square Garden and you filled it up, there would be one person that would have been so honored. So for many years after the war, we could talk about why there were a number of reasons, but rescue and the altruism and courage was really not a very overlooked area of Holocaust studies and of studies of World War II in general. People were really much more interested in the evil. They were interested in why people collaborated and went along with it, which was the vast majority of people, why people just stood by and did nothing. And very little attention was paid to these handful of people who, a number of them who actually risked their lives to save people. In many cases, they didn't even know, and in some cases, people they didn't even like. And to me, those are some of the greatest stories of heroism in the history of the world. And they also, I started writing these stories, as you mentioned, for various newspapers, and I got enormously positive feedback. People find them very inspirational. People want to hear about them. There are great lessons we can learn from them that are relevant for today. And we have evidence that people like them because, for example, the movie Schindler's List, which is about a rescuer, is one of the most critically acclaimed and commercially successful movies. But yet, these stories remain largely unknown. One of the my first chapter is about a Portuguese diplomat named Aristides de Souza Mendes, who, over the course of 3 weeks, may have saved as many as 30,000 people. It's the largest rescue by an individual in the entire Holocaust, and yet almost nobody knows his name. And so part of my purpose for writing the book was to, A, out of gratitude to people like that, and to correct the historical injustice, in my view, that everyone knows who Goering and Himmler are, but people don't know who Souza Mendes is, and they deserve our honor and our respect. But even more importantly, I think the lessons and the example of these stories can do good in the world today. And I'm not suggesting we're anywhere near close to anything like the Holocaust, but there is a lot of pain in the world. There's been 40 genocides since World War II. There's a lot of polarization in our country, and looking at the worst moment in history and why people, you know, chose to do good when everyone else around them was doing quite the opposite, I think is really important.
And although we're going to spend most of our time talking about incredibly dramatic instances of rescue, and of course that is really the heart and soul of your book and of these 10 different stories that you tell. And I want to make sure we understand these are nonfiction stories. These are true stories, not penned out of your own imagination, but these are real people and actual instances of rescue. But one of the things you also mention in the introduction to your book, I think, is worth a brief mention, and that is the fact that we need to also be mindful of even the smallest gestures of good that were done in the midst of this horror, even if such gestures do not necessarily kind of rise to the level of representing an actual rescue, which is, of course, the highest good that could be done. But I want to read this passage and then have you expand on it. You write, "As I wrote this book, I often imagined what it must have been like for a refugee, hunted, terrorized, with nowhere to turn, to come upon the kindly face of a rescuer, a friendly smile in a hellish landscape. We must also recognize the gift of dignity and of goodness, the small gestures made to acknowledge someone's humanity. A coffee, a hot bath, a smile, a kind word, which were almost always recalled years later by survivors as helping give them the strength to go on. They do not often on their own add up to a dramatic story, but they were crucial and certainly something that we can all do every day. Why did you think it was important to say that in the introduction of this book?
Yeah, well, that is a pattern that many people, as I said in that passage, recalled that Primo Levi, the great Italian physicist who wrote one of the most famous memoirs when he was put in Auschwitz, remembered that when he was still in Italy and he was interned, a laborer, I think he only knew his first name, Lorenzo, would bring him soup every day. And he actually said that this man, by bringing him soup and acknowledging his humanity, actually saved his life and allowed him to go on. So that I wrote in part because it's important to know that, you know, not everybody is going to risk their life for other people. It's not a reasonable expectation, you know, at this time in certain parts of Europe, if they caught you, they would kill your family as well. So these were very extreme examples. But what I've also looked at is community rescue and places. There were some places in Europe where almost 100% of the Jews were saved, and those were places where everybody came together either actively or tacitly, and those were places where things like what you just described when you read my passage happened all of the time. And they are things that we can do. And, you know, people make fun of this anti-bullying campaign a little bit, but I actually think it's quite important, because what I learned, and I wrote an article for the Wall Street Journal about this, about community rescue, is that when you have a culture and a society where people are kind to one another, and also where, and it starts with children, where when people see someone being mistreated, they stand up for them, and where that becomes actually the view of the majority, that's where we start to actually make real inroads against hatred, against bigotry, against prejudice, and prevent anything like the Holocaust ever happening again. And also, you know, again, it's something everyone can do. So I it's something that people who were on the run for their lives remembered years later. So it obviously had a huge impact, and it's something, you know, that you don't have to be saving someone's life, but if you bring some joy into their day or make their life a little bit better, that's extremely valuable too to making the world a better place. Hmm.
We're speaking with Richard Hurwitz about his book, In the Garden of the Righteous, The Heroes Who Risked Their Lives to Save Jews During the Holocaust. And I want to be sure that you offer just a brief word of sort of clarification or expansion on that intriguing title, In the Garden of the Righteous. Explain the garden to which you are referring.
Sure. Yeah. So the Garden of the Righteous is actually a real place, and it's at the Yad Vashem, which is the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Israel, in Jerusalem. And it has been part of that museum's mission from the beginning, among other things, in terms of, you know, telling the story of the Holocaust, being an archive. They have also had a program to honor the righteous. And when someone meets the criterion, which I mentioned earlier, which is, again, quite stringent, you can't be Jewish, you have to have risked your life or your livelihood, there has to be eyewitness testimony. So there's a lot that goes into getting this recognition. They get a medal and are called the Righteous Among the Nations, and they plant a tree in a garden for every person who gets that award. And that garden is really now of something of a forest. So it's this very beautiful, poetic place at the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem, where, you know, there are all these trees that are in bloom and meant to symbolize, I think, the kind of the gift of life and that these people gave to those who were on the run. So that's the title of the book is In the Garden of the Righteous. Most of the rescuers that I talked about have received that title.
Right. And I love the way you describe its dedication back in 1962 with Golda Meir on hand, 11 trees planted, and now, of course, there are hundreds more. And you say, the rescuers were like drops of love in an ocean of poison. I guess those were the words of Golda Meir on that occasion. Your book, as we have said, consists of 10 stories of rescue. And again, just to briefly mention that other book, I remember talking to Alexandra Zabruder about the difficulty she had in choosing, I think it's a total of 15 Holocaust diaries, when there were dozens of others that were nearly as worthy of inclusion, but you just can't make that massive a book. And so, and it was just so painful for her to leave out of her book other diaries that she so much wanted to share with the public. And likewise, I should think for you, it probably was not easy to limit yourself to a mere 10 stories of rescue. Explain what went into your thinking in terms of what kind of array of stories you wanted to share and what they collectively represent.
Yes, that I did have a very similar experience. And in fact, the initial proposal that I had would itself have been probably a book twice the length of my book. And if I had wanted to include all the stories that I know of that are, I find, you know, equally inspirational, it would have been an encyclopedia. Nobody would have read it. So, there was this, process, and I talk about in my introduction a bit, different, stories or, different rescuers and stories that are, I didn't include, but which, are definitely worth knowing about and worth learning about. I tried to pick, so pretty much, in my view, almost every rescuer, no matter how dramatic the story is pretty much unknown unless it's Raoul Wallenberg or Oskar Schindler. I mean, those are the two archetypes people have heard of, and maybe some people know the story of Denmark, but it was not, I didn't include either Schindler or Wallenberg because I feel like their stories are out there. I tried to select what I thought was a spectrum that represented the different types of rescue that went on. So there are stories from all over Europe, from Poland to, Italy to France. I tried to pick different types of people, different motivations, different professions, whether it was diplomats or social workers, again, different geographies, because the experience was very different. I included some stories of community rescue, and I wanted to have sort of a cross section of the different types of rescue that went on. There's a story, as I mentioned, of the rescue of 30,000 people. There's also a chapter of the rescue of one 16-year-old girl by 10 British POWs. And then I also tried to, they're really also just at the end of the day stories that spoke to me or which I found particularly dramatic. The book is meant to be a good book to read as well. So the way, some of them are, I think they're all really good stories as well. And bring some of them are, have some unusual color to them. There's one story of a rescue in a circus. There's the story of Gino Bartoli, who won the Tour de France in 1938. He's one of the most celebrated athletes, one of the most famous athletes, not only in Italy, but in Europe, which was completely mad for cycling at the time. And he ended up hiding a family of Jews in his basement and saved 700 or so people by being part of an underground. And he's, I just found that fascinating that this celebrity athlete did this amazingly heroic and brave thing and never really told anybody about it for years. So they're all kinds of, they're all meant to be good stories because, they're sort of set pieces or cinematic in some kind of way, because I think, again, you want to pull people in to really understand what went on. And again, this was a moment of great drama in the world.
For sure. And I think you've chosen brilliantly. I really do. Because you mentioned him, I want to talk for a moment about Gino Bartali, Tour de France champion in 1938, at the time one of the most famous athletes in all the world, and someone who had absolutely no use for Benito Mussolini and what he represented. And Bartali, as you recount to us, was tireless in his efforts to do some good in the midst of something so horrific. One of the things that is so interesting is how, because he was a distance biker, this gave him, in your words, a kind of unique placement and gave him, in a sense, unique opportunities that would not have been possible for others. For instance, at one point when he begins traveling long distances by bicycle, it would as though he was training for his next race, but in fact, he was doing something else and serving the resistance effort. And that is something he could do that just about anybody else could not do. I mean, physically and otherwise, and also because it would have drawn undue attention. Just say a word about that matching of a particular person, who they are, with an opportunity which they then had the courage to seize.
With respect to Barclay.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, there are certain things that all of us can do, and then yes, there were certain people, you know, diplomats are one example because they could give out visas that, you know, they weren't uniquely positioned. Barclay was extraordinarily uniquely positioned because he was so famous, and again, he had the excuse for why he might be out riding, you know, literally hundreds of miles. He also had the ability to ride hundreds of miles in a single day, which was also fairly unique. So he was part of a underground network that was run by members of the church. It was spearheaded by the Archbishop of Florence, who was his kind of spiritual mentor, Cardinal Della Costa, also the Archbishop of Geneva, the Bishop of Assisi, and some Vatican officials in Rome. And what they were doing was hiding mostly Jews, but also partisans, some soldiers who had deserted in various places around the north of Italy, because after 1943, when the Allies invaded, the Americans and the British, and we occupied the south, but the Germans at that point actually entered Italy and occupied the north. And one thing to note is that generally under Italian occupation, Jews were safe. They were discriminated against, but they were never rounded up. But when the Germans arrived, it became very dire in the north. So this group of, mostly clergy ended up hiding a lot of people in monasteries, in convents, even in the cloisters. And they call it the Assisi Underground because a lot of them are actually hidden in the town of Assisi, which is, you know, the home of Francis. And Bartoli was asked to be a messenger, basically, for the underground. And very important were counterfeited papers. So people would have, papers that under false names that weren't Jewish, and they would look for names actually from phone books in places in the south, like Naples, because they knew that, you know, that's where that was occupied, and so there was no way of checking out the names. And what he would do is he would put these papers in his bicycle, either under the seat or in the kind of crossbar, and he would bike from these different cities and deliver them often in one day. He also did reconnaissance for the resistance. And what was amazing about it, right, is because he did it in plain sight. He was dressed in not only his cycling uniform, but his name was on the back. And he had permission when he had been drafted earlier in the war to actually continue to use his bike instead of a motorcycle so he could stay in shape. And he was, you know, everyone loved him in Italy. So even when he would be stopped at a checkpoint, people would want to talk to him. And he could say to the soldiers also, like, don't touch my bicycle. It's perfectly calibrated for my racing. And so everyone said, no, nobody should bother Barclay's bicycle. And he would be waved through. And there are other stories of him showing up in train stations and sort of everyone would see him and mob him. And while he was being mobbed and signing autographs, his colleagues would be moving Jews from one train to the other because he created this huge distraction. So because of his celebrity and his athletic ability and the fact that he was so beloved in Italy and it was such an important sport for the Italians, you know, he was really able to do something really, really unique and amazing.
Hmm. I want to be sure that we also talk about another amazing athlete who figures in your book. a Dane by the name of Knut Marstrand Christiansen. And he is talked about in a chapter called Miracle on the Øresund, in which we learn the remarkable story of Denmark and how Denmark rose up collectively to a remarkable extent and were able to save the vast majority of Jews in Denmark. But this Knut Christiansen was a very significant part of a dramatic rescue effort like none other recounted anywhere else in your book. Briefly describe to our listeners what he was part of.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the story of Denmark is really remarkable because the survival rate for the Jewish population there was almost 100%. It was around 99%, and it started from the day of the occupation. And there's a story that the king of Denmark wore the Star of David in solidarity with his Jewish subjects, who many places in Europe they had to wear a Star of David. But that's actually not true, because in Denmark they would not even permit the Jews to be discriminated like that. And it was part of the stipulation from the beginning that, you know, religious bigotry was anathema in Denmark. It had been outlawed legally several hundred years before. There were 7,200 Jews that lived there. They had been there for centuries. The Danes considered them, you know, as Danish as anybody else. They were their neighbors. They were their friends. They were their colleagues. The entire country from the beginning basically said, we will not abide by any discrimination against the Jews. And Denmark was considered Aryan by the Nazis, and they had at that point, you know, they didn't want trouble there. So they kind of went along with it for a while, until it actually got up to Hitler himself after a couple of years. And he himself personally ordered the deportation of all of the Jews of Denmark. And they scheduled a roundup on the high holiday, the Jewish high holidays, because they knew everyone would be at home. And as I tell in my book, there was a member of the German government there who basically tipped off the Danish government that this was about to happen. And the Danes, as a country almost, came together, everyone from medical students to taxi drivers, and they sent the Jews into hiding, and then they brought them in this massive flotilla that was very much like Dunkirk. It was many amateur boats, fishermen, and they brought pretty much all of the Jews across the straits to Sweden. And they got out, almost all of them, like 500 were captured and sent to a camp called Theresienstadt. But even those, the Danes continued to check on and send food and medicine. They would call them, and they inspected the camp, and almost all of them survived. But Knut Christiansen, who you mentioned, was an Olympic rower. He'd been in the 1936 Berlin Olympics. His wife had actually been in Berlin a couple of years earlier studying to be a chef, and they both had seen like the horrible discrimination and violence going on against Jews there, and were horrified by it. And so they knew about that when they came back, and when the Nazis occupied their country, they became very active members of the resistance. And when this flotilla happened, again, you a little bit like Bartley, Knut Christiansen was able to. He was such a great rower; he could actually row back and forth between Denmark and Sweden. And so he took a number of people, rowing them himself, all across the straits to safety in Sweden, which was neutral. And one of the people he saved when he got to the other side, by when he turned around to thank him, he had disappeared. And the guy was so grateful that years later he tracked him down, and they had a reunion on television. And he said to him, you know, I never got your name, and why did you rescue me, and why didn't you, you know? And he said, why? You know, my mission was over, and I just did what anybody else would do. And that, you hear that over and over from these rescuers. They really didn't view that what they did was anything particularly unique or special or heroic. They just viewed it as the decent thing to do. But he was another athlete again, who in this case, you know, the skill that was needed was to go across. And again, there were many boats going across, but he was one of the. If not unique, the very rare people that was actually rowing a like sort of a you know, Olympic skiff back and forth between two countries.
Incredible. And by the way, in this chapter, there is something else that I just love. And this comes towards the very end of the chapter, towards the very end of the story, when Germany surrenders in May of 1945, and the Danish Jews are able to return to Denmark. And you write, the Danish Jews were in for one final surprise. All across the country, they largely found their homes untouched when they came back. In many cases, their plants had been watered and their pets fed, their homes painted and filled with flowers. Some discovered that their neighbors had even managed their businesses for them in anticipation of their return. I mean, the kindness of the Danish people went on even beyond the actual rescue, and just speaks volumes about this the remarkable story. But I want to make sure that we take a couple minutes to talk about chapter 2 of your book, which is titled Life in the Circus. And this is one of the most amazing stories of them all, in which you talk about the circus and about the circus being a very multicultural world in which many Jews were able to thrive in an exceptional way. And then, of course, a certain circus ended up being a safe harbor for many Jews in the circus world when suddenly things began to shut down and they began to be pursued. Just briefly talk about this incredible story.
Sure, yeah. So the circus, I don't think it's coincidental that this happened in the circus, because, you know, one of the things that I think has really made people more likely to help others is the extent to which they were exposed to lots of other people who are different from themselves. And the circus, even today, is very multicultural. It's also a family business, right? So whenever you go to the circus, they always say, there's this acrobat is the ninth generation of such and such family, you know, and that was true 100 years ago. And I actually did a lot of research into the history of the Jews in the circus, which I didn't even know about, that, you know, there were a number of very prominent Jewish circus families, you know, who not only owned circuses, but performed in them. One of them was a family called the Lorches. They had perfected an act called an Icarin, which everyone would be familiar with if I could. I don't know if I can describe it, but it's basically when someone lies on their back and like kind of kicks up another person in the air and they do flips. And this was a sensation, and they were actually the star attraction at the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. They were in residence in New York as the highest paid attraction in the world. So they were enormously successful. And then in the 1930s, the Jews were systematically kind of driven out of the circus. They were not allowed to perform. Most of the Jewish circuses went bankrupt or were bought for a song by Nazi party members. And then eventually, by the late 30s, they were actually being, and early 40s, being rounded up and deported and sent to concentration camps and murdered. And so, you know, you had these, you know, many of these families were quite large, and you had basically almost all of them wiped out. One of the members of the Lorch family, a girl who was about 18-year-old acrobat, Arena Danner, she approached a German circus owner, Adolf Althoff, and his wife Maria. He was the ringmaster of his circus. He was from a family they used to call circus royalty. They were one of the inventors of the circus during the Renaissance. And his wife performed with elephants, and they knew the family a little bit. And this girl had been basically was unable to get a job, and she was afraid for her life. And she asked him if he could like give her a job and have her perform. And hide her. He ended up not only hiding her entire family, and then she ended up actually marrying a clown in the circus, and they had two children during the war. So the family grew, and they actually, there was a whole, the wife of Maria Althoff actually had to find a doctor that was willing to treat a Jewish pregnant woman. And so she actually, Irena's creditor was saving her life just doing that alone. But what they did is it was an amazing story. They had these Jews in the circus performing under false names, and the circus was traveling all around Germany. And at every stop, it would be inspected by the Gestapo. And Adolf Althoff, the ringmaster, was would serve them brandy, and he would tell them amazing stories about like dancing with bears in Russia and other kind of circus lore. And at any point in time, anyone could have denounced them, but they were able to do this, and it was a very popular circus. So there were, you know, thousands of people, including members of the Gestapo and the Nazi Party, would come to the Altsov Circus when it was in town, and had no idea that they were watching, you know, a number of Jews perform in the circus who were hiding, hiding, and were successfully rescued over several years. So it was a successful rescue operation, and the girl and her family remained friendly with the Altsovs, you know, for decades after that.
Hmm. In our last couple minutes, you pose an intriguing question in the introduction. You say this: we are fortunate that we do not need to know how we would have acted during the Nazi era, but the math says that very few of us would make the same choices the rescuers did. It is one thing, and a challenging one indeed, to simply inconvenience oneself by taking the time or offering the resources to help another in need. It is even more difficult to jeopardize your livelihood or well-being, let alone to risk your life, or even more extreme, the lives of your children. Most of us would not. Do you want us to give serious thought to this question of what would I have done were I one of those bystanders in a situation like this? Is there value in posing that question to ourselves?
I think there is, for a couple of reasons. First of all, some of us might do that. These were not people. I mean, one of the things that I found really illuminating in writing the book was I was able to interview the children of many of the rescuers, and it was a mixed report. So some people, you know, almost described their parent as a saint, but others found their parents to be difficult or distant. And so these were real people. They were complicated people. These were not people who set out like Mother Teresa, you know, to be like, you know, to dedicate their lives to others. These were people that found themselves in situations and reacted in a certain way. And I think there's a lot of hope in that, because they weren't saints. They were people with flaws like all of us. And they just, you know, made the right decision when things happened. So I think most of us wouldn't, as I said, do something this extreme, but I think that there's something really great if people think that they would. But I think as importantly, there was, so you mentioned Anne Frank earlier, you know, Holland had a mixed record, but it was better than some other places. And one of the rescuers there said, you know, we were the tip of the spear, you know, these people who risk their lives. You know, we were the tip of the spear, but the reason we were able to be successful was because the majority of the population really sympathized with what we were doing, and so they would look the other way, right? And that really also made a difference. If you were in a country where somebody like Bartoli was, you know, doing something heroic, and people around him kind of were quietly supportive and didn't, you know, look, which was the minority of countries. In most countries, people ran to turn people in. They did it for money, often very small amounts of money. They denounced people for spite. They did it because they were anti-Semitic. They did it because they wanted to get someone's house. And so I think, you know, there's a spectrum. And so for those people who are sympathetic because they admire what these people did, you know, that is really valuable. I mean, I remember in the Bartoli story, there was a counterfeiter, and he was actually a former Italian soldier, and he was part of the making false papers. And he ended up one day, Germans walked into his shop, and he was almost caught, and he ran to this priest who was part of the Assisi underground. He said, "I want out." And when he ran to the priest, he actually saw this young guy with a bicycle, and he said to the priest, he was about to tell him, "I'm out of this, I'm done." And he said to the priest, he said, "Was that Gino Bartoli?" And the priest said, "Yes, but you can't tell anyone." And years later, the guy said, he went back and he continued his work, and he said, "The fact that I was involved with something so heroic, and that somebody like Gino Bartoli was risking his life for these people, made me feel like, how could I do anything?" And he was doing something, you know, obviously like risky, but a little bit less. How could I not be involved in it? You know, and that was really, you know, that was an example of the inspiration happening in real time, right, at that time.
Mm. Let alone all these years later. You say in the introduction, the extraordinary stories of the rescuers are too little told and too little known. fortunately, your book is here to help tell these stories, to revive our interest in these powerful tales of courage and compassion. The book, again, is In the Garden of the Righteous, the heroes who risked their lives to save Jews during the Holocaust. The book published by HarperCollins, the author Richard Hurwitz, and the book even includes some wonderful photographs in which we see some of the courageous rescuers and the people they helped. Richard Hurwitz, thank you so much for giving the world this really important book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. Best wishes to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And to finish out the Monday Morning Show, here is an excerpt from my conversation many years ago with Alexandra Zapruder, author and editor of the extraordinary book Salvaged Pages, Young Writer's Diaries of the Holocaust, a collection of 15 diaries similar to the diary of Anne Frank, carefully selected and edited by Ms. Zapruder.
In the beginning, when I sort of conceived of the idea to do this project, initially I thought that there would be, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 diaries in the book. I didn't ever imagine that I would know about 55 or 60 of them. It never even occurred to me that there could be so many of them. But I began to read as much as I could about young people in the Holocaust and about the Holocaust in general, and I sort of in an informal way started accumulating references to diaries. You know, I would be reading something and there would be a quote from a diary or a reference to a diary or a footnote about a diary, and I found myself with these lists of names of young people who had allegedly kept diaries. So the initial phase was one of research in which I gathered these names of people and went to the publishers or the writers or historians or scholars or museums or archives or wherever in order to try to get a copy of the diary in the original language or in whatever language it existed. And so that was sort of the first phase. And then the second phase was getting the material translated into English, because there did come a certain point when I understood that I would never be able to make any assertions about the body of material unless I was able to read as much of it as possible and to really survey it in some kind of comprehensive way. So I raised quite a lot of grant money, thanks to the generosity of a number of truly wonderful people, hired a number of translators who were working in all different languages. The diaries themselves were written in all the languages of Europe, and had the material translated into English. And as the material came to me, I began reading and reading and reading and reading it again and again and again, and trying to see what the big themes were and what the commonalities were and distinctions and what emerged from the body of material. And then, of course, there was the process of putting it together in a book, at choosing which diaries would be in the book, editing them, and doing all of the research that was required to introduce them to the public. So those were sort of the broad phases. It was really a gathering, broad gathering in the beginning, and then gradually culling through it and narrowing it down so that it could take some form that people could digest.
A couple of questions come to mind, or points. One of them is that you mentioned in the whole phase of translation that in at least a few cases, these young writers were fluent in more than one language and utilized more than one language within the body of a single diary, which, of course, complicates the whole process of translation.
Yes, one of them, the most complicated diary, and I had a wonderful translator for it, but the most complicated diary from that point of view was one that was written in the Lodz ghetto in Poland in 1944, and it was written in 4 different languages. Now, one of the languages was English, so at least that one wasn't such a problem, but the other languages were Yiddish, Polish, and Hebrew. So I needed to find a person who was fluent in all of those languages and who could render the text into English. So there were challenges. And then there were other cases in which, for example, a diarist might have been writing in Yiddish, for example, in Lithuania, and there would be Lithuanian words sort of scattered throughout, and the translator might not necessarily know Lithuanian. So sometimes I had to pull people in order to help uncover certain kinds of mysteries. But in general, the translators were extremely knowledgeable about the history of the Holocaust and about European culture or the culture of the language, the country that they were translating from. And so they were able to figure out nuances or explain things away that I would never have been able to understand. So they really fulfilled multiple roles. In some cases, they were doing research for me as well as translating the diaries.
What about the whole issue of legibility? The fact that we are probably talking about, in many cases, diaries that were written down under less than ideal situations, settings, and so on. First of all, what kind of form did the diaries take by the time your translators were working with them? Or were they working from facsimiles of the original written diaries, or had by that point had they been typed out? And to what extent was that a difficult process in and of itself?
It depended on the situation. I mean, it's a great question because it sort of, it was such a complicated process. In some cases, we were working from Xeroxed copies or, you know, photocopies of the original diary. And in some cases, for example, in the case of Klaus Langer's diary, he wrote in the Gothic form of German, which isn't really used anymore, but it's not a form that everyone knows. And so that it was that poses its own set of problems. But and then in other cases, translators were working from type scripts. So, for example, a diary, an original diary, might have ended up in an archive, and someone somewhere along the line made a typescript of it so that it could be preserved on microfilm or for whatever reason. And that was obviously preferable because it's a little easier to work with. And in terms of the handwriting, sometimes it was very difficult. And there are some parts of the diaries that are just illegible, and there's really nothing to be done about it. It really depended. And then there were other problems that came up. For example, sometimes there were diaries that, there was one diary that was written originally in Hungarian and had been translated into Hebrew and then translated into English. And the original Hungarian diary had been lost. So the sort of closest generation to the original was itself a translation. Hmm. Now, it turned out that diary didn't need to be retranslated for the book. I didn't end up using it, but that's the kind of situation that could occur. You know, and in a perfect world, what any translator wants, I think, is to work from the original or whatever is closest to the original, including the handwritten, because that's the way to capture the flavor of the diary best. If you're already working from another generation, mistakes can be made, or there's always the interpretation of whoever translated it in the intermediate stage.
Of course. You just touched on what I think is a point of maybe exquisite complexity, and that is choosing what diaries to excerpt for the purposes of this book.
Mm-hmm.
I think, first of all, that must have been so painful in a sense, because it's not like you were assembling a book of photos of Elvis Presley or something, and there's only room for 70 of them, and we're just going to leave out these other 50, although it would be fun to include them. We're not talking about that at all. We are talking about precious words from innocent victims.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there was a part of you that could discard, in a sense, these certain diaries. I would think with a real sense of regret.
Mm-hmm. It was. I mean, I think that's quite right. And it's interesting because in some ways, I kept having to reprimand myself. You know, here, the whole message of the book is that these diaries are not, they don't equal lives, and that I'm not rescuing these young writers, and that nothing can be done. And yet, there is that emotional feeling that somehow those writers whose diaries are reprinted in the book are somehow going to be known and remembered in a different way. And so in some ways I felt that very deeply, and it was extremely difficult, especially when it you know, there were sort of 20 diaries that were really they were the 20 that I wanted to use, and I had to cut 15 I had to cut 5 or 6, and those were the most difficult choices. And I used to lie on the floor of my study and just look up at the ceiling and sort of talk myself through it, you know, and try to be as rational as possible and think, you know, there's a reason to include this one versus that one, or there's a, you know, and try to make the right choices. But it was extremely difficult, and it took a long time every time I had to face the fact that another one needed to be, you know, cut from the collection. It was sort of a 2 or 3 week process from the dawning of the idea to the actual acceptance of it. So it wasn't, that was definitely difficult.
Alexandra Zapruder, author and editor of this extraordinary book called Salvaged Pages, Young Writers' Diaries of the Holocaust, published by Yale University Press.